straightening himself to his full height, and then knelt down in front of me.
"Corn Cadence, will you accept me into your service?"
"What?" I blinked.
What are you doing?
I mean, I knew, but...
"I'm asking for you to formally make me one of your retainers. I know that's not a simple request. I brought a copy of the oath, if you're willing."
I laughed, putting a hand to my head. I'd always wanted a retainer. Someone to watch my back, to tell me when I was being an idiot. Someone who could cover for my weaknesses and reinforce my strengths. Of course, I'd expected it to be Sarah kneeling in front of me. If life had taken a little different path, we would have taken formal oaths to each other the day after we'd received our attunements. This was better. I didn't want someone to be my bodyguard because their family had pressed them into my service as a child. Patrick's motives might have been skewed by a desire to be close to Sarah, but that was fine. He'd stepped in to defend me against Teft on the first day of classes without me even needing to ask. He'd stepped in to deflect a shot that would have hit me right at the beginning of the Warcane test. Then we'd fought side by side. And moreover, he'd treated me like my 3-year disappearance had never happened. He was still the same friend I'd known since childhood. That was the kind of person that I could trust. If he was willing to take this serious of a step in order to be closer to my family, all the better. I couldn't see how having a retainer with a close connection with Sarah would have a downside. I smiled and knelt down, my eyes level with his.
"I'm bad at tradition," I explained, "but I'd be honored to have you as a retainer, Patrick. You've always been a loyal friend, and if you want to say the oath, I know the words."
He winced.
"I'm going to need the note. Well, get it out then."
Patrick opened his pack, retrieved a carefully rolled scroll. A scroll? This really was formal. He broke the wax seal on the scroll and unrolled it, and he began to read.
"I, Patrick Wayland, do hereby swear my loyalty to Corrin of the House of Cadence. I offer him my strength of arms, my wise counsel, and my life's blood. I will serve no other master. I will make no other oath that would betray this one. I will take no action that would betray my master's trust. I offer this service of my free will and with honest intent. May the goddess witness this oath and bind me with this pledge."
I felt a foreign pang of emotion that I couldn't quite characterize. I'd never been good at emotions, but there was something bittersweet about the scene we were playing out. I think a part of me wanted to let out a few tears in that moment. I took a deep breath.
"I, Corrin Cadence, do hereby accept you, Patrick Wayland, into the service of House Cadence. I will be sheltered by your strength, be guided by your counsel, and be preserved by your blood. I will honor your oath with my own. I will entrust you with my safety, for you are my shield. I will entrust you with my knowledge, for you are my guide. And I will grant you my strength, for you are my hand. My house is now your own, and you will always have shelter there. I accept your bond of my free will and with honest intent. May the goddess witness this oath and bind me with this pledge." I closed my eyes, and with the slightest hint of a tear forming, chuckled softly, "Arise, Patrick, retainer of the House of Cadence. I think we have some paperwork to sign." He extended his hand, and I clasped it, and with that, we stood as one. I spent much of the rest of the day with Patrick, between dealing with the paperwork that we'd need to mail off to formally make him my retainer, and just discussing how he should approach Sarah about the dance. We ended up agreeing that we'd wait until we received a formal acceptance of his new status before he'd ask. Not because we thought Sarah would disapprove otherwise, but because it would put Patrick in a stronger position. When I handed in the paperwork at the courier's office, I knew the first place it would be going was to my father. His signature would be required to formalize the process. Even as a potential family heir, I couldn't take on a new retainer without his express permission. I didn't foresee any problems, though. If any, this would probably be one rare event in which my father would actually be pleased. Earning a retainer would help legitimize me as a noble. I hadn't passed Patrick my glove.
That was a more significant step, essentially trusting a single favored retainer to be my primary one. Since I didn't even have multiple retainers, it seemed like the gesture wouldn't mean as much. I'd planned to give it to Sarah when we'd been young, but she'd been literally groomed from birth to protect me, so it would have been strange not to. In retrospect, I hoped that bringing Patrick into my service wouldn't offend Sarah. It was possible she'd been considering asking him to work for her, but I didn't think it would pose a problem. Retainers in service to a specific family member were still expected to be a part of the household and work closely with everyone else in the house. Serving me in specific was more of a formality, at least from my perspective. Of course, if he actually wanted to try to marry her, that would be a bit more complicated, but I wasn't thinking of that as a serious possibility. We were teenagers, and he had a passing crush. Probably. I didn't really understand relationship stuff. Anyway, with that hurdle cleared, I got back to my work and my newly acquired pile of gold. Sarah's letter had unfortunately left explicit instructions on what I was supposed to do with it. Corin, I've been working on a priority list for items that I think we need for the next test. Of these, I believe my top priorities are as follows. Mana storage or some other method of increasing my mana capacity. A method for increasing the power of my summoned creatures, ideally something to provide a vast amount of power in an emergency. Teleportation or flight. Stronger defense measures. Healing. I would like for you to build me as powerful of an item as you can for one of the five above functions in order of priority. If any gold is remaining after the first item is completed, focus on the second and so forth. You may keep one of the six coins as your commission. See me if you have any questions. Yours, Sarah. I wanted to argue with her priorities to work on what I thought was important, but I couldn't disagree with her. That was actually a really solid list. I did, however, need considerably more detail to know which option to work with. So I went to visit Sarah to ask her directly. She wasn't at her room, so I ended up spending the rest of the day working on my own projects. I finally remembered to talk to her again a couple days later. When she opened the door to her room, she folded her arms, glowering at me. Corin, to what do I owe the magnanimity of your presence? I blinked.
I wanted to talk to you about the items you wanted?
She wrinkled her nose. What? You didn't want to just decide on something important like that without me?
No. I scratched my chin. You're pretty obviously angry at me, but let's assume I'm a complete jerk and don't know what you're talking about.
Ugh! Come in! She gestured and I followed her inside. She shut the door loudly, but I wouldn't quite call it a slam. Back to folded arms. I just received a letter from Father asking what I think about your decision to offer a retainer position to Patrick.
Oh. Well, this is awkward. And you're mad because I didn't ask you about it first?
She nodded firmly. Patrick and I are friends too, you know. Did you never consider that I might have some input? And a retainer? That's a very serious decision, Corin. Not just for you, for the whole house.
I winced. She was right about that, of course. And I'd more or less promised to treat her as an equal, so making an executive decision about Patrick without even bringing the idea up to her might have been a little bit hasty.
I'm bad at these things, Sarah. Sorry. I put my hands up in a gesture of surrender. This is not a matter where a simple apology will be sufficient, Corin. Did you ever consider that maybe, just possibly, I had been thinking about making him my retainer?
Afterward? I admitted, but that probably would have made things more awkward.
What? Is asking me something really so difficult?
I lowered my eyes, shaking my head while I considered how to address the situation.
No, it's not that at all. There were special circumstances. If I told you more, it might be a problem with Patrick.
She narrowed her eyes.
Are you saying you didn't consult me because Patrick has some sort of problem with me? Because, you know, that would be an even bigger reason to talk to me before.
It's not that, Sarah. I sighed. I'm bad at this, so Patrick is just going to have to forgive me for being blunt. Has he asked you anything, event-related recently?
She frowned,
looking briefly introspective.
No.
I wiped my forehead.
Okay. Spoiling the surprise here. He wants to ask you to the Winter Ball. And since you're a noble now, he was worried that would be inappropriate. Of course, asking you to make him your retainer right before asking you to a dance would look like he was just trying to get in your pants to move up the social ladder. So, you made him your retainer so that he could have sufficient standing to ask me to a dance. I made a concluding swish of my hands.
Precisely!
She put a hand over her eyes.
Are you daft, Corin? You let him take a lifelong sacred oath so he could ask me to a dance?
When you put it that way, it does sound pretty bad.
But he was so sincere and adorable about wanting to ask you.
Sarah sighed, folding her hands in front of her.
Corin, for the future, please promise me you will not make any life-altering oaths in order to influence my love life.
I considered that for a moment.
Wait, wouldn't agreeing to that be a contradiction? I mean, wouldn't I literally be making...
She took a step closer, looking me in the eyes.
Corin! I'm not kidding with you here. I am not amused by this, but I can tell you didn't have any malicious intent. You thought he was being romantic. Fine. That is not a sufficient reason to make a decision regarding our house without my knowledge, especially if it was to enable someone to court me.
That wasn't the only reason. I really did want Patrick as a retainer. I took a deep breath. I wanted to argue, to snap back that the oath was between me and Patrick. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that she had a point. I'd put her in a bad position. If he'd gone this far out of his way just to get the standing necessary to ask her to a dance, saying no to him would be devastating. Which meant that I just put a bunch of pressure on Sarah, without even considering how she felt about the situation. I turned my head away.
Okay, you're right. I made a decision that impacts you without even thinking about it. I'm sorry, and I won't do it again. From this point on, I'll talk to you about any other house-related matters before I make any decisions.
House-related, or anything pertaining directly to me, Corin.
I nodded.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just didn't want to ruin the surprise of him asking you. You know, I understand, Corin. If he was just asking for advice from a friend, that's fine. I don't expect you to tell me about that. But for what it's worth, you don't know a thing about my love life. You've never asked. And as it happens, I already have a date for that dance.
Oh. She folded her arms.
And now, you get to share in my awkwardness, assuming Patrick ever gets up the resolve to ask.
And that was how I learned to never interfere in the relationships of my friends. It was about 20 more minutes before we'd finally finished talking things out and gotten to a point where she was willing to talk to me about business again. I pointed at the list.
Okay, first item, mana storage device.
She sat down on the floor and I sat across from her, the paper between us.
Yeah, seems rather obvious. Running out of mana is a common problem, so I could use something that would help me refill my supply.
I figured that was your plan. Unfortunately, that particular route won't work. She twisted her lips.
Why not? It sounds like a simple enchantment.
It is. It would, however, also probably kill you.
What?
I chuckled. A little hyperbole, maybe. So when I enchant something, the item basically has my mana signature on it. Even if you store mana in it, that mana is getting exposed to my mana that's in the device all the time. And mana belonging to other people is generally toxic.
Even for siblings? Wouldn't we have similar mana?
I hadn't thought of that.
Maybe? I don't actually know how dangerous that would be.
Probably less than it would be for strangers, yeah.
We probably do have similar types of mana, but I don't know how far that goes. I've never heard of anyone sharing mana.
And while I wasn't going to say it out loud, she just finally started to forgive me for my blunder with Patrick, I wasn't actually certain we were siblings. Half-siblings seemed more likely, if even that. Knowing my father, this whole legitimizing her could have been a political game of some kind. Could I determine that through magic?
Almost definitely, I decided. I imagined magical paternity tests were probably routine for cases where people were accused of infidelity, and someone had probably come up with a way to test people further removed for bloodline connections.
like to determine if someone was from a royal line, for instance. I'd have to look into that at some point. Okay, so it'd be a risk. How hard would it be to try it with just a small amount of mana? I scratched my chin. I don't actually think you could use a storage device, even if I made one, unless you have a spell to pull mana out of things. Shapers can do that, and I think more advanced enchanters might be able to, but I don't think it's a standard thing for all attunements. Oh, I guess I was just picturing something where I push on a rune and it starts sending mana into me until I push the rune again. I shook my head. Your skin would block it. We're all naturally resistant to mana getting into our bodies from outside sources. It's not a simple process to force mana into someone. That's part of why you see so many offensive spells that focus on throwing projectiles, or making an attack explode right in front of someone, rather than, say, making a fireball inside someone's body. Even if you made physical contact, which would make it somewhat easier, you'd have to force your mana through the body's natural insulation. She stared at the page, looking contemplative. Huh. I don't think I'd ever managed to stymie her so thoroughly before. Nice. Wait, what about how Derek's monster helped recharge my mana during the survival match? I thought about that. I don't know a lot about how monsters work, honestly. I assume it had some way of purifying the mana to make it safe. Then it probably had to force a lot of mana into you to get through your skin. I can't make an item that does that at my level of skill. She seemed to accept that answer, but I decided I'd have to look into it more at some point. Mana recharging items could be useful. In the meantime, I had an alternate suggestion. If I had mana in an item and put a rune on it to eject it into the air, would you be able to reshape it into a spell? Sarah frowned. I don't think so. If it was ice mana, maybe I could make an attack out of it. But doesn't mana dissipate quickly in the air? Yeah, it'd be inefficient. You'd probably lose a lot of mana that way. Don't know another way to make a storage device you could use, though. We sat for a minute in silence. What about something that just added more mana into a spell I'm casting? Maybe. I considered the idea. How would that work? I don't know enough about how your spells work to answer that, honestly. I pretty much just shove mana at things. So, my incantations determine the spell that I'm casting. Different incantation, different spell. Except there are these things called shaping lines. They're extra lines I can add to an incantation to change the way it works with an extra cost. When I finish the spell, my attunement draws the necessary mana out of me and the spell happens. I nodded. Do you guide your attunement toward which parts of the body it draws from? Yeah, I can do that. How? Just by thinking about where I want to take it from. I scratched my chin. There's some potential there. Then, if you could get your attunement to think an item was a part of your body, maybe it could reach into the item to pay the mana cost. But that might mean passing the mana through the object into your body before the spell goes off, which could, as we discussed earlier, make you sick. If you could even use the item at all. Okay, what about setting up the item to detect when I'm casting a spell, detect the result of the spell, and channel mana into the result? That seemed possible, but it also didn't seem to help. Yeah, you could do that, but I don't think it'd make your spell any cheaper. She pointed at the second item on the list. I was thinking something more like that, or in between the first item and the second. Oh, to make the spell stronger? Yeah, that actually seems pretty doable. But would just throwing extra mana into a summoning spell actually do anything useful? She nodded. Yeah. Summoned monsters are really good at shaping mana for their own uses. Remember that Carvenzi I summoned? Sure. I frowned. Now that you mention it, he was casting a lot of spells. And spells I couldn't provide the mana for. I don't have lightning or fire mana. Summoning spells use transference, air, and gray mana. He got the mana that was left over from the spell after I finished summoning him, and he reshaped it himself. If I'd given him more mana to work with, he could have done more with it. Huh. That reminds me. Wasn't he using some of the same spells you were, but without incantations? Yeah, using incantations for broad area spells seemed to primarily be a human limitation.
Monsters shape their magic naturally, so they generally don't need them.
That was interesting. Could I figure out a way to set things up for a human to distribute mana across a broad area without incantations like a monster could?
One more research project for the long list.
Okay, yeah, I think we can make a spell enhancement item work. In fact, I could probably make something similar for Patrick if I can afford it.
She frowned when I said Patrick's name. That was not a good sign.
I continued. Anyway, do you want me to spend everything you gave me on the one item or try to save some for additional items?
Give me the strongest thing you can make. We can always make more items later. I'd rather have one really good item that isn't going to be replaced when you get stronger in a few months.
I agreed with her logic.
Okay. Do you want something that's self-recharging or something we have to manually refill?
She raised an eyebrow.
What's the advantage of the latter?
Half as many runes for me to make, so I don't have to buy as many crystals. That means I can buy a bigger crystal to give it a larger mana capacity.
Got it. Go with that, then.
You sure? That means you'll probably only be able to use it once per test. If even that, recharging something we make with a big crystal is going to be hard.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'd rather have a strong emergency measure.
Okay. What mana type do you want?
That one took her a minute of consideration.
Gray.
As much as I want to say ice, it'd be too hard to recharge, and less generally useful.
I didn't quite understand her hesitation. Wouldn't gray work for anything?
She shook her head.
For any summoning spell, yes, but not for my normal offensive ice spells, and I might want to hit something with a really powerful ice storm rather than call on a summoned monster. I can convert gray mana, of course, but that's inefficient.
Oh, well, that makes sense. Maybe if this ends up working, we can make you an ice one eventually.
I'd like that.
But let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. I'm not that rich.
I grinned.
Not yet.
Okay, let's settle on this one as my next project. But I wanted to discuss some of these other ideas for the future.
The rest of the conversation was much more pleasant, but I knew that I had a lot more work to do before she was going to truly trust me again.
Chapter 16. Testing Phase 2. Professor Meltlake floated, rather than stood, in front of the class when I arrived and took my seat. She was only about 4 feet above the ground, but it was both noticeable and impressive. She sat on the air like a cushion with no clear gestures or words to maintain the spell. Given what I recalled of Meltlake's previous lectures, I suspected the effortless manipulation of mana was a calculated move on her part. While Teft preferred direct confrontations for shock and awe, Meltlake liked to draw us in with little casual uses of magic that brought out our curiosity. At an otherwise unremarkable moment, one I suspected to be the precise moment an unseen clock ticked to the starting time of our class, Meltlake lifted her head and glanced around the classroom, her lips twisting almost imperceptibly downward. That muted displeasure was an uncomfortable pressure for me, even though I suspected it was directed at those students who were still sitting down. Or worse, those few that remained absent.
Students, attention!
We turned our gaze toward her, conversations silencing in an instant. If we had a military salute, we probably would have given one, but we weren't quite at that point in our training yet. If I handled things right, I'd never get to that point. I had no intention of joining the military, not for traditional service at least. I couldn't afford to. I knew it was extremely unlikely that I'd make it to the top of the tower before graduating. Most stories of successful climbers indicated that they took decades to reach the top, and success stories were rare. I needed to make sure I scored high enough to qualify for becoming a military-sponsored climber when I graduated. Even if I did rescue Tristan before graduating, I still had no interest in joining the military. Military service had destroyed my great-grandfather's mind. The military had taught my father to discipline me into success. I didn't want to end up like either of them.
Today we'll be discussing Velia's relationships with the most prominent kingdoms on Kaldin.
We'll discuss the smaller kingdoms as well as kingdoms on other continents in future classes. We'll begin with our geographic neighbors, Delanos in the north and Edria to our south. The mention of Delanos made me think about Jin. There were a considerable number of foreign students here, but I'd only seen a handful of others from Delanos. They were notoriously insular. Not necessarily xenophobic. They didn't seem to have any problems trading with Velia or with our own students visiting them. But my impression was that they were very patriotic and that most of their citizens weren't very interested in learning about our culture. Professor Meltlake turned one hand upward and opened her palm. If this is Velia, a white cloud, roughly triangular in shape, but with deep gaps that presumably represented bodies of water, then this would be Delanos. She opened her right hand, and a blue cloud manifested. This one was more rectangular in shape. It formed along the northwestern angle of Velia's triangular shape, stretching both further west and north. The rectangle had a large chunk missing from the center, and another on the southern side. The first one represented a big lake with a name I could never remember, and the second presumably signified the unclaimed lands, territory infested with vicious beasts that had never been fully settled. Delanos is unique among our nations in that they are directly led and guided by one of their visages, Katashi, the Visage of Justice. While we use the term kingdom for simplicity, they are not a kingdom in the traditional sense. Their monarch is largely a figurehead. Katashi, and by extension his priesthood, control all legal and military forces in the region. Thus it is more accurately referred to as a theocracy. A student I didn't recognize stood up to indicate she had a question. Professor Meltlake turned her head. Yes, Constance?
Aren't we all theocracies, then? I mean, don't we all follow the same goddess?
Constance asked, sitting back down. Professor Meltlake shook her head. While all nations on the continent do revere Selyse, praise be to her name, most of our governments draft their own laws without direct guidance from the visages. Each of the largest nations, often colloquially referred to as the Four Powers, do have some form of guidance from a patron visage. This generally comes in the form of occasional advice to the rulers or council. In Delanos, Katashi and his priesthood directly control the rule of law. If there is a significant dispute, the priesthood can escalate the question to Katashi directly. He spends much of his time living directly among the people of the city in his grand cathedral. Another student stood up.
Does that mean that Delanos is more important than the rest of our nations?
Meltlake actually laughed. That was a rarity. They'd certainly like us to think so. Historically, however, it's more complicated than that. Five nations, including our own, used to have a visage that lived among them and helped govern in some capacity. While Delanos would claim that their visage's presence means that they're the only ones who still deserve the honor, the rest of our governments tend to think we've just outgrown needing divine oversight. As for who is right? The professor shrugged. That's a question for the visages, not for me. The student sat down, a thoughtful expression on his face. All I could think about was how glad I was that we didn't have a visage watching over us all the time. One encounter with Katashi had been more than enough for my tastes. Meltlake glanced around, presumably checking for more questions, and then continued after a few seconds. Delanos is the home to the Tortoise Spire. Of the six shifting spires, the Tortoise Spire is the least explored, mostly due to how difficult it is to earn the right to explore the tower for non-citizens. While all other nations allow travelers to explore their shifting spires for a modest fee, visiting the Tortoise Spire requires an application and interview process. This process can often take months or even years. Thus, any visit to the Tortoise Spire must be planned far in advance. Next, she waved her right hand, manifesting an expansive red cloud that stretched beneath both of the two existing ones, and even further out to the west. Edria. Or, more formally, West Edria and East Edria, though the distinction is falling apart these days. Edria is the single most powerful military force on the continent. She squeezed her hand, illuminating a flickering boundary between the two portions of Edria. During the 6 Years' War, Edria invaded our bordering kingdom of Kelridge. At the time, Kelridge was a part of Delenos. Delenos's queen was a Kelridge native. She remained in the nation during the invasion, refusing to surrender even when Edrian troops had surrounded her fortress. Along with her loyal retainers, she endured a full year of grueling siege, hoping that her allies from Velia or Kaelferd would push back the Edrian troops. But we never succeeded in dislodging them. They called her the Unbroken Queen. Meltlake shook her head. Perhaps she would have withstood the siege even longer, but her people were starving. She was assassinated, and most believe it was by one of her own people. With her fall, Kelridge officially surrendered and became East Edria. Those who remained loyal to the Unbroken Queen maintained the house's surname, Daelin, as a way of honoring her. Of course, the royal family of Delenos still uses the same name as well. The professor pointed her hand again, causing the western border of Velia to glow. With Kelridge conquered, Edria pushed further east, all the way to the Velian border before finally ceasing their assault. I knew that history all too well. My great-grandfather, Alaric Cadence, had defeated one of the invading army's officers in single combat to end the war. I was sure that duel was more of a formality. They would not have ever agreed to the duel if they hadn't wanted an excuse to stop the military push. Edrian forces had been encamped in the bordering mountain range for months without being able to successfully push into Velian territory. And with winter rapidly approaching, the duel was a way to end the conflict in a way that saved face for both sides. While some took this as a sign of Velia's impregnable defenses, most of my family believed that Edria was simply biding their time for a better opportunity to strike. After all, they'd already obtained what they truly wanted in the push. The professor explained that next. During the conquest of Kelridge, Edria became the first nation to control two of the Shifting Spires. Edria was built near the Hydra Spire, home of Orochi, the god Hydra, and historically that had been their primary source of attunements. Kelridge was home to the Phoenix Spire, the seat of Suzaku, the god Phoenix. Another student stood up. Lei, one of the few students I knew, was from East Edria.
Professor, not to be disrespectful, but we do not refer to Suzaku as a phoenix, nor would we call Orochi a hydra, or even a god among them. They are distinct creatures.
Meltlake nodded. Ah, I was wondering if someone would bring that up. In Velia, Miss Zhang, we refer to each of the god-beasts by their closest analog among common monsters. It is merely a categorization tool useful for our citizens to easily visualize and remember each of the towers. I understand that in East Edria, Suzaku remains a deep part of your culture, and that conflating it with an ordinary type of monster may come across as disrespectful. Please understand that no disrespect is intended. And we do teach more detailed information about each of the god beasts and their histories during the 2nd year. Lei frowned, but she simply said, "Thank you, Professor," and sat back down. It was obvious she wanted to say more, but I think she was smart to leave the issue alone. I sincerely doubted that any further argument would accomplish anything. I probably would have been more sympathetic if I thought of the god beasts as anything other than horrifying monsters of city-shattering power. I knew that East Edria thought of Suzaku as a positive force, more like how we treated the Visages, but I'd never been raised to think of the god beast that way. It was difficult to imagine a powerful monster being anything other than terrifying. "Now," Professor Meltlake continued, "some of you have asked me why we still allow people from Edria to visit in spite of the movements of Edrian troops along the border. The answer is that we are, most definitively, not at war. Troop movements are commonplace for both of our countries, and we have been at peace with Edria for decades. While we must remain vigilant, Edria has shown no sign of overt aggression." I heard some murmurs of disagreement among the class, but Meltlake didn't stop talking. "I know that many of you are concerned, but our soldiers are well trained, and we are quite prepared for any potential attack. Perhaps more importantly, Edria is still allowing our own citizens to visit them freely, including making the treks to both of their towers. Most military experts believe that Edria would cut off our access to their towers and expel our citizens before attempting any military action.
Initiating a war while we had capable attuned deep inside Edrian territory would be an extremely dangerous move. A few nods of agreement at that, but I wasn't one of them. How many attuned could we possibly have visiting their towers? A couple dozen, maybe, if that? I was confident that 20 or 30 attuned loose in a warring nation would be a frustration, but I sincerely doubted they would be a sufficient threat to deter a war. Professor Meltlake was probably just trying to keep the class from worrying, and I understood that, but I didn't necessarily agree with it. Then again, I had a tendency to overthink things. Not everyone appreciated obsessively theorizing the same way that I did. Now, Professor Meltlake twisted her left hand, manifesting a silvery cloud on the far western side of her map. Kaelford is the last of the four powers. They are an industrious nation, famous for their mechanical engineering and scientific experimentation. We consider them our closest allies, both due to their assistance in the 6 Years' War and our many centuries of trade prior to that. She closed her hands, causing both Velia and Kaelford's clouds to glow brighter. Perhaps even more importantly, they border Edria on the western side of the continent, where we border Edria on the east. If either of our nations should fall, the other would be at substantial risk of being attacked next. Grinning, Professor Meltlake continued. Kaelford is the home to the Tiger Spire, where Byakko, the god tiger, resides. It's also the home of Ferris, the most active of the visages aside from Katashi. Ferris doesn't run the government. Instead, she works directly with her citizens on science and engineering projects that interest her. She's also notoriously informal. She travels without a retinue and dresses in ordinary clothes, which has led to a few rather embarrassing mistakes over the years. I pictured someone trying to kick a drunken visage out of a bar. That sounded hilarious. That's one visage I might actually be interested in meeting. Maybe I could get her to teach me more about how attunements actually work. Professor Meltlake lifted a finger and drew a line across the map from Kaelford to Velia. While we've always had robust trade with Kaelford, and the cross-continental railroad that has made shipping goods far easier than any previous point in history, for this reason the railroad is extremely well-maintained and well-defended. We have military bases at several locations along the rail, including 2 small bases in the unclaimed lands. It is very possible that after your attunement training is completed, you could be assigned to protect one of these key locations. Now that's it for the four powers. Another student stood up. Professor Meltlake raised an eyebrow. Yes? The student folded his arms.
You mentioned 5 of the shifting spires. Aren't there 6?
Professor Meltlake nodded.
Yes. The location of the Spider Spire, however, is a closely guarded secret. Most of your fellow students will guess that it lies in the unclaimed lands, but I'll say this. That's not the case. There is a tower in the unclaimed lands, but not one of the 6. Now that got my attention. I knew that the Spider Spire's location was a secret. I'd even spent some time unsuccessfully trying to figure it when I was younger. I was curious about that. But I was even more interested in this other tower. Could there be a 7th spire? If so, would it be possible to get different attunements there?
I was just about to stand up to ask a follow-up question. And that's all the time we have for today. Class dismissed.
Oh, cruel temptation. She wanted us to wonder. I sighed. Mysterious Towers was one more thing I'd need to fit into my research schedule. If this secret tower was connected to the 6 shifting spires, maybe it could help illuminate some additional secrets about how the towers truly worked. Late one night, I heard a knock at my door. This was not all that unusual in itself, but I was still a little bit worried about potential assassins. I brought my sword with me as I approached the door.
Coming!
I opened the door a few moments later. Jin was standing outside. He was standing with his back straight, wearing an intensely serious expression.
Corin?
I waved at him. Oh, hey, Jin! Don't have any more items ready for you just yet. Sorry. He shook his head.
I am not here for that.
I raised an eyebrow. Oh? What can I help you with? He raised a gloved hand to his chin.
It has been brought to my attention that there is a formal social event coming up in the winter. It is customary for students to attend with a date.
I winced. The last time someone had asked me to help them find a date to the ball hadn't exactly ended well.
You want me to ask someone for you?
Jin tilted his head downward and laughed nervously.
No, Corin. I want you to come with me to the ball.
Oh.
Oh.
I blinked.
I mean, as a friend? Or as a date?
As a date, unless you have an objection.
Breathe, Corin. You can think about it.
Thinking. Right. I did some of that breathing thing. I didn't know what to say. Jin had stood out from the first moment I'd seen him. He was strange. He seemed smart. Our interactions always left me grinning. Was I attracted to him? I mean, he had a pleasing aesthetic, athletic body and all. I liked the shape of his chin. But that just meant I liked looking at him. I still didn't... What if he wanted to... It honestly never occurred to me that this might be an issue. I had no interest in asking anyone out, and the thought of someone taking an interest in me hadn't crossed my mind. Now that he'd asked, though, could I date someone? My face was reddening. I closed my eyes for a moment, flexing my hands in the air and taking a deep breath. Okay. Breathing now. I think I'm interested. I've never really done anything like this before. And, just so you know, I'm not that into touching. He nodded.
I've noticed. It won't be a problem. We can dance if you decide you want to. If not, I would be more than happy just to have you there to talk with me.
I laughed, just a hair too loud to be natural.
Dancing. Is that all? I think I can handle dancing.
Maybe.
Maybe just talking. Talking is fine.
Okay, let's go with that then. It's a date.
I look forward to it.
The slightest smile crossed his lips.
Good night.
I nodded hastily.
Okay, great. Good night.
Jin closed the door. I stared at it for another few moments before retreating to my bed, heart pounding in my chest.
What have I done? I don't know how to date.
In spite of my panic, a spark of excitement had been lit. As the minutes passed and my anxiety faded, I once more found myself grinning after our conversation. I had a date. 20 weeks into the semester. It was time for our second major exam, and I didn't feel anywhere close to ready. We assembled for a strategy session the day before the test. Fortunately, we were using Marissa's room this time on account of it being much larger than mine. She was still in the tortoise's heart, indicating she was getting excellent grades, but the rest of us were still stuck in the normal ones. Except for Jin, maybe. I wasn't actually sure if he was still in the room above me. I rarely visited him directly. He'd usually found me. Even with the extra room, it was pretty cramped with 5 of us, but I was glad to see everyone, especially since I had presents. I passed out the sigils first, since I had one for everyone. They were a simple enough design, a few runes etched into the back of a copper phoenix about the same size as our usual existing shield sigils.
What's this?
Patrick accepted his phoenix sigil, fiddling with the pin on the back.
Should I put it on?
Wouldn't hurt anything. I handed out the last one, which Jin eyed dubiously. They're self-recharging shield sigils, higher capacity than the class-issued ones, and if they're drained, they'll refill completely in about an hour. You can still recharge them manually, but you won't need to unless it's an emergency. Marissa blinked.
Wouldn't something like that be super expensive?
I grinned.
If you had to buy them, sure.
Fortunately, aside from the metal, I made everything I needed myself. They're not much more complicated than a standard shield sigil, just a few extra runes to make them recharge automatically. Jin scratched at his chin, turning the phoenix over in his hands.
Useful? I wasn't aware you had reached the point of making carnelian-level items en masse.
I chuckled. Don't worry, I haven't forgotten your list. In fact, I managed to get one of your higher priority ones that I couldn't make before. I dug through the pouch on my side, withdrawing a monocle on a chain. This one had been the toughest project yet, in part because of the amount of mental mana it required, and in part because I had to borrow a shadow to test if it worked. Took 3 attempts to get everything working right, but it had been worth it. I handed it to him gingerly. I wasn't going to risk tossing something so easily breakable. In retrospect, maybe I should have thrown a resilience enchantment on it, too. Jin lifted the monocle over an eye, frowned, and looked at his right arm, which promptly vanished. I blinked, and I heard a few gasps from the others. We'd seen plenty of magic before, but Jin rarely showed off his capabilities in public. Is he showing us a bit more trust, or is he just doing this as another step in obfuscating his real attunement? I could ask him about it, but that might get him to retreat back into keeping everything to himself. If he's a spider, he probably can't tell us anything more than he already has without losing points. His arm reappeared a moment later. "Acceptable," he pronounced. From the tiny curve of his mouth, though, I could see that I'd pleased him. Patrick nudged me.
"You going to share what that was with the rest of the class?"
"True seeing," Jin explained. "It sees through illusions and deceptions."
I raised a finger. "Not quite true seeing, unfortunately. That's a higher level version of the same effect, but it generally functions the way you described. It just won't work on extremely high level illusions." Jin gave a curt nod.
"Of course. Thank you."
"You got it." I turned to Marissa next. "Your turn, Mara." She blinked.
"You actually got me something? There's no way I can repay you for any of this."
I laughed, startling her. "You're a part of the team, Marissa. This is my contribution." I looked around at the rest of the group. "Something we all need to be clear about. I'm not going to be able to pull the same kind of weight within the tests as the rest of you. Preparation is my strength. Sure, I'll contribute ideas and muscle once we're in there, but as you all get better with your attunements, the gulf in our abilities is only going to grow." I folded my hands together. "Best thing you can do to thank me? Use these, both within the tests and outside them. And if they don't work the way you want them to, let me know. I can make adjustments or hand the item to someone else and make you something different." I took out a plain copper bracelet and passed it over to Marissa. "If it makes you feel any better, this was the simplest item of the bunch. One of my favorites, though." She accepted the bracelet, turning it over in her hands.
"What's it do?"
"If it detects you sending mana through your arm, it sends more. It's a standard design for guardians, nothing fancy. Won't interfere with your abilities, it just makes them stronger." Marissa snapped the bracelet on, grinning.
"Means a lot that you remembered what I wanted. Can't wait to hit something and see how these work."
"Figured you'd like them." More digging through my bag before I produced a leather glove. "Ah, Sarah. Yours." I tossed it to her. She caught it with narrowed eyes.
"This is a House Cadence symbol."
Oh, yeah. I kinda had that made for you." I winked at her. She took a deep breath.
I never gave you a proper gift to welcome you into the family, but you're family, and it's about time I started treating you that way."
She slipped off the blank glove she'd been wearing, trying the new one on.
"It's a little big."
I chuckled.
"I didn't know your exact size, so I had to guess. You'll grow into it."
"I'm 17, Corin. I don't think my hands are growing that much more."
I waved a hand dismissively. "We can get it tailored. That's not the enchanted part." More digging through the bag until I produced a metal bracer, which I passed to Sarah. "I was going to make you a demigauntlet like mine until I realized that would cover the house symbol. You should be able to strap this over the glove without a problem."
"This what we talked about before?"
She inspected the runes on the surface, then started strapping it on over the glove.
"Yep. You see the bottom rune? The one that looks kind of like a guy with horns?"
"That looks nothing like a guy with horns, Corin."
"Okay, but you see what I mean. I'm not an artist."
"Thank the goddess for that small kindness."
I raised 3 fingers in a rude gesture. "Anyway, if you want to use the bracer, touch that with your other hand and channel just a little bit of mana into it. Like what you'd do with a dueling cane. That primes it, and it'll use the full mana reserve next time you try to summon something." She nodded.
"How much did you manage to store in there?"
120 mana. Sarah blinked rapidly. I didn't think you even had that much. I lifted my necklace, showing off the 46 of 46 displayed on it. I'd gotten much stronger over the last 3 weeks of rapidly making items, but still nowhere near the mana held in that device. I cheated. There are 4 separate storage runes in there, each with 30 mana in them. That's still more than I thought you could do in one session. I tapped the necklace to my right hand, changing the display to 58 of 58. I couldn't charge that much if it was mental mana, but the mana stored in those is gray. I charged them from my hand. Jin gave me a quizzical look. Why do you have more mana in your hand than your attunement? Oh, right. I hadn't told everyone about that. Paralyzing fear? Nothing for you to worry about. I tapped the necklace to my forehead again, setting it back to monitor my mind. I got nervous any time it wasn't actively doing that. Jin raised a hand to his lips, looking like he wanted to say something more, but he remained silent. Then, Sarah hugged me.
Thanks, Corin.
Human contact too much? I patted her awkwardly on the back, suppressing a shudder. It's just Sarah, I told myself. Hugging Sarah is fine. She's safe. You're safe. Comforting her when she was injured had been easier because I had initiated it myself. I still wasn't good at handling other people touching me. It was easier with Sarah than anyone else, but she'd surprised me. I probably would have panicked less if I had a chance to brace myself.
You're welcome. Thanks. Hope you like it.
She released me a moment later to my great relief. Patrick looked at me expectantly. I strongly considered pretending I didn't get him anything, but it was too much effort. And, of course, I saved the best for last. I tossed Patrick the ring, a House Cadence symbol on it. Signet rings weren't common in Velia. Gloves usually serve the purpose of marking a noble house here. Rings were more common up in Delanos, where they tended to be more traditional. If we'd been down in Edria, I'm pretty sure my gesture would have been considered a proposal for marriage. Anyway, the ring itself wasn't a big deal, like giving him a glove would be, but it was still a symbol of the house, which made it a good gift. And it was metal set with a gem, which made it great for enchanting.
Nice!
He slipped it on his pointer finger immediately. Fortunately, it looked like a good fit. I'd assumed correctly that he'd wear a ring about the same size as I did.
What's it do?
It's similar to what I made Sarah and Marissa. It enhances your spells, but more like Marissa's. It puts a bit of extra mana into every spell, rather than using it all at once like Sarah's. Also, it only works for lightning. Apparently gray mana works for enhancing lightning, but it wouldn't help other elemental spells. Patrick grinned wide.
Lightning's the best anyway.
Excellent. So now that I'm bankrupt, let's get to the actual planning session. We spent the next couple hours talking strategy and going over everyone's new capabilities. We'd all been talking pretty frequently over the last 10 weeks, so nothing was particularly surprising. Sarah still had access to the creatures she'd bound during the survival match, but she didn't have enough mana to summon the wyvern. That was fine as far as I was concerned. The ogre and Carvenzi were more than good enough. The Carvenzi had been considerably weaker than the wyvern in terms of raw power, but its intelligence and flexibility had made it just as effective, if not more so. Patrick had been training with Meltlake constantly, but he'd shown a stronger affinity for lightning than her traditional fire spells. Fortunately, Meltlake was still capable of teaching those, and he'd picked up a couple noteworthy spells. A lightning storm that would periodically rain bolts on enemies, a weapon electrification spell, and a chain lightning spell that would jump between enemy targets. Marissa had spent the vast majority of her time developing her shroud. When I briefly turned my attunement on, I was shocked by the intensity of it. Her shroud was already vastly stronger than the phoenix sigils I'd made us, and she seemed to be maintaining it without any effort. I wondered just how much damage it could deflect, and what else she could do with it. Jin assured us he'd gotten better at everything, and left it at that. It was the end of the night when I showed them what I'd made for myself. A saber with gray and transference enchantments layered across the surface to increase the striking power. It was a poor substitute for the Selyse Leanne, but at least I had a weapon I was allowed to use. I'd considered a dueling cane, but I didn't need one. A saber was a better close-range weapon, and I had the gauntlet to handle ranged attacks. I wished I'd had more time to make some items focused on utility, detecting traps, increasing mobility, teleportation, unlocking boxes and doors, but I'd pushed myself to the brink of exhaustion just trying to get these last few items ready in time. That had also prevented me from making any items that were specifically intended for the test rooms we'd already seen. My priority was making sure the items that I made would be flexible enough to work in multiple tests, as well as the actual Serpent Spire. Fortunately, now that I was capable of churning out roughly 2 or 3 magical items per week, I was confident I'd be much better prepared for our third test. Assuming we didn't fail out of the school during this one, of course. And with that rather sobering thought in mind, I made my way back to my room to sleep. We didn't have a second-year student to prep us for the test this time. We had Professor Orden. She was wearing a tailored black suit as usual, but she had her hair up in a bun today. Some sort of special occasion, maybe? She usually kept it down.
Ah, some of my favorite students. Make sure to entertain me.
The group exchanged worried glances. The preparation room was the same. I glanced at the 3 exit doors with my attunement on. 2 of them glowed with purple auras, presumably the effect that would teleport us into the testing area.
Same rules as last time, Orden explained, leaning on a long dueling cane. Any questions?
Sarah shook her head.
No, Professor. I believe we're clear.
Great. Who's sitting out with me?
We'd agreed on our plan the night before, but I still felt a little nervous. Marissa spoke.
I'm starting outside.
Orden raised an eyebrow.
Really? You're leaving your guardian behind?
The teacher shook her head incredulously.
Well, whatever. Your funeral. Head to your doors, kids.
I nodded, heading to the same door I'd taken last time. Patrick was with me. He'd be our muscle. Jin and Sarah headed for the other door.
Good luck,
Sarah offered to us.
Same,
I replied. Professor Orden walked over to each group and handed a member of each team a return bell.
Don't forget these.
We accepted our return bells. I tucked mine away in my bag, turning toward the entrance door.
And begin!
I turned the door handle, swung the door wide, and appeared on a pedestal in the midst of a chamber filled with water.
Oh, Resh, we're in the wrong room.
We'd talked about several different ways the test could go the previous night. The test could have been identical to last time. Same rooms, same configuration, same tricks. We considered the possibility of a completely different test, too. Or that the tests might outwardly look the same, but have subtle changes to trip us up. We'd spent hours discussing ways to prepare for those more complex scenarios. We'd never planned for the very simple idea of them swapping the entrance doors. If we'd pre-planned for this scenario, it'd be trivial to just use the bells to switch rooms. But we don't have any way to coordinate that now. I really should have made an item to send messages. I took a deep breath, scanning the room. It was bigger than the other chamber, but not by much. I could see several pedestals that were within jumping range, just as the others had described. I could see the swirling of something moving within the water, too. As much as the disruption was terrifying, the consistency with what the others had described to us was a comfort. We hadn't explicitly prepared for this, but we had shared information. We knew what we were up against, and we could probably handle it. But we did have a better solution. I took the bell out of the bag.
Swapping for Mara. She's been in here before.
Patrick nodded.
Sorry if you're bored out there.
I shook my head.
No problem. Don't get killed.
I rang the return bell. Sitting in the waiting room wasn't exactly an epic adventure, but I felt like we'd taken the smart route, even if I didn't get to contribute as much personally. Sometimes the success of the team was more important than my personal excitement. Professor Orden was sitting in the waiting room. She raised an eyebrow at me as I appeared.
That was quick. Losing your nerve, Cadence?
Nothing like that.
I wasn't expecting you to switch the room configuration on us. Mara will be better at handling that room since she's been there before. Orden made a noise. Perhaps. We sat in relative silence for the next few minutes.